Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. We're going to be looking today at some of the issues surrounding poverty and disability. I've been asking myself lately, what's access like for those with mental health issues? Can they get a fair shake when it comes to income, access to health care, respect in society? To answer these questions, in this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Russell Rosinski from York University. So tell me a little bit about how someone with mental health issues might have things like financial status and status in society and access curtailed.
So, I think the number one challenge when we're thinking of people with mental health issues, status in terms of finances, is a lot of the supports that are out there for people with mental health issues aren't exactly designed for the episodic nature of people with mental health issues. And so the subsidies and programs don't exactly give a place for people with mental health issues to fall back on if what they're experiencing becomes worse. And it kind of adds this sort of pressure to always perform at the level as someone without a mental health issue, or at this kind of like optimal, almost like capitalist sort of standard, which then kind of puts them in this place that they're maybe like a less than person, someone who's not maybe fully a person. And I can go into maybe explaining a bit about the decision that Doug Ford's government made last week and how that's really affecting people with mental health issues. And it's really kind of put them in a very bad place in terms of their safety and security and therefore their status in society.
Certainly. Love to hear about it.
So last week, Doug Ford made that decision to, with ODSP, so the Ontario Disability Support Plan. And the decision was that, well, he's grandfathering people who are currently on it, but for new people, the standard is now at the same level of the CPP, a federal level, for what a person, what disability status would be, which is a stricter standard. And everyone else, people who would now be applying for support, people with mental health issues, for example, would be put on OW, Ontario Works. And the idea with that for Doug Ford is that and he also made it so that getting onto Ontario Works is easier and you get payments faster, but the money is typically less. And the idea is that you're working still. You get working, but you're still getting some money on top of that. And the government also cited that you know, there's no real taxes or income tax for people who are making, like families or individuals making, or I guess households technically, $30,000 or below, saying that this is a better way to get people working and help the economy and will help the person. So. With people with mental health issues, it's not necessarily that they have a disability, they don't have a disability for like permanently the same someone with a severe physical disability might have. So it's more episodic. And with this new kind of legislation that the Ford government put in place, it's now put, it's going to make it harder for people with mental health issues to access supports when they're going through a mental health, I guess you could call it a mental health distress or a period or, so they actually have to work hard, they have to work in a way, somehow they have to work through it.
So, to this end, someone with a mental health issue might not be able to find work as easily as there might be that stigma or the reluctance to disclose. Do you have any thoughts on this?
Yes. Well, they definitely won't find work as easily, or they might not find the supports for work as easily. And I guess the stigma then comes. And it's very, the stigma is almost very similar to the kind of stuff that you would see in historically before World War, before World War II and before the Great Depression, that, you know, in the early 1900s, when it was, you know, pull up your bootstraps and go to work. You know, if you're quote unquote able bodied, then you should be able to work. You should find a job. That's not an issue. And that, you know, why would you have, if there's something, if you can't get a work, there's something wrong with you and that you're not fully, I guess, human.
So,
and this, yeah.
So they're basically creating their own vicious cycle here.
Correct. And even economically, if you're looking at society, like society now versus like North American society now versus North American society, you know, in the early 1900s, the differences between the really rich and the rest of society is just as big of a gap as it was then, back before we had all these labor laws, and unions, and all these what we call now the residual welfare state, so with all these like protections like your Canadian pension plan, your you know, unemployment insurance, et cetera, et cetera. So we're experiencing it financially. We're in the same place, and the same attitude seems to be prevailing. So it is definitely like a cycle.
So how do you suggest that we as a society veer away from these attitudes and create something that works?
That's always a the tough question. But I would argue that the best way to go forward is something along the lines of these minimum wage laws. But some of these minimum wage laws are more than just giving, a raise. Some of these minimum wage laws are including, like, you know, paid sick leave. And I think that is important because when we look at the research, the countries that work that have the fewest, like, work days, which are typically your Nordic countries, so your Sweden, Denmark, Norway countries, they actually have apparently like happier people. They are actually more productive, and working less doesn't actually mean, like working less hours doesn't necessarily mean you're working less productively or getting less product out to market.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Perfect.
In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Rachel Arnold from Disability Rights International. She'll be telling us a little bit about what really goes on in asylum settings for those affected with mental health conditions. Tell me a little bit about your experience with Disability Rights International and disability asylum practices.
I've been working for Disability Rights International for 4 years. My role in the organization is managing our communication and being kind of a general project manager for a lot of the work that we do.
And can you tell me a little bit about some of what you've learned in regards to disability asylum treatment?
Sure. Coming into this position, I didn't know very much about institutions and the legal side of the treatment of people with disabilities in the United States and around the world. And this position has been learned an incredible amount. So Disability Rights International has existed for 25 years. And in that time, our staff have monitored institutions and asylums around the world and documented the treatment of people with disabilities inside those asylums and institutions.
And what are some of the biggest challenges facing those in these institutions?
The biggest challenge has been, I think, the lack of choice, the lack of legal capacity, and the mistreatment that we very often see in these institutions. What we've seen over and over again around the world is that when people are locked away in institutions and asylums, it's very easy for abuse to thrive when there's nobody checking up on you, when there's no recourse. If you're mistreated, it's very easy for abuse to thrive. And so all of those issues together, being separated from your family, being locked up, and not having, in some cases, the legal right to challenge, no recourse. You can't go to the police. You can't appeal to anyone higher than the director of your institution. That leads to abuse, and it's very difficult for people who are in these institutions and asylum to access help.
So how does DRI go about providing some sort of answer to this?
The main thing that has been very effective for DRI has been exposing these kinds of abuses. We document the conditions in institutions, and we're often able to get extensive press coverage of our findings. And so that really puts the pressure on governments to change their practices. Now in the international system, we have the Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities through the United Nations. And the main tenet of the convention is that people with disabilities have a right to live in the community and have choices equal to others. And so governments that have signed on to this, governments that have signed on to this convention and ratified it have a legal obligation to ensure that they're following what it says and enforcing these rights for people with disabilities in their countries. And so documenting abuses, exposing them, going to the press, it helps put pressure on government to live up to their legal obligations to people with disabilities.
So if you could send any one message as to why this is vital in society, what would you say?
I think it's absolutely vital because, as I said, and it's enshrined in the convention that people with disabilities have the right to live their lives with choices equal to others. And when you're in an institution, you don't have that right. You're not able to choose where you live, what you do during the day, what you eat, basic things that people who aren't institutionalized take for granted. And I think that's incredibly crucial.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Of course.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Canadian Blood Services invites you to save a life today. Every 60 seconds, someone in Canada needs blood. Donating is simple, and your blood will go to help Canadians undergoing heart surgery, leukemia treatment, or those involved in an accident. Go online and book your appointment today at www.blood.ca or give us a call toll-free at 1-888-2-DONATE. That's 1-888-236-6283.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Russell Rosinski and Rachel Arnold. In this segment of our show, we're going to hear from Ann Summers, the U.S. National Council on Disabilities. She'll be telling us a little bit about how the sub-minimum wage law allows for people with disabilities to find themselves in impoverished situations. So the last time you were here, you were telling me a little bit about the legal right for employers to pay people with disabilities below minimum wage. Give me a little bit of a refresher on that.
Sure, and it's good to be back. In 1938, so during the New Deal policies of the U.S. government, the Fair Labor Standards Act was passed into law, and most of that law is wonderful. It finally set up some safety regulations against child labor and definitely provided a lot of protections for American workers. However, it contained a provision known as 14C, that at the time was thought to be a very charitable provision that allowed employers to hire people with disabilities and then pay them below the federally mandated minimum wage. And that section, 14C of the Fair Labor Standards Act, is still good law today. And over 300,000 Americans with disabilities are paid below the minimum wage because of that provision.
So can you give me an overview of how this reduced income might actually impact their overall lives?
Yeah, good question, Cam. I guess I want to start off by reminding your listeners of the goals of the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is our federal civil rights act for people with disabilities in the U.S. The goals are supposed to propel U.S. policy for all Americans with disabilities, and those goals are, there are four of them: independent living, economic self-sufficiency, full participation, and equality of opportunity. So when we're talking about something like subminimum wages and the policies that perpetuate these outdated models, we really have to start by recognizing how incompatible they are with every single one of those goals. So to answer your question, if you're paid pennies an hour, which some people are, they're literally paid a couple cents an hour for their work, you won't be independently living, you won't have economic self-sufficiency, you certainly won't be fully participating in society, and there's definitely not an equality of opportunity with your non-disabled peers.
So would this lead to things like a person with a disability not disclosing in a job interview for the fear that they might not get employed or find themselves in a reduced setting simply because of their condition?
Most of the time, subminimum wages are paid in very specific environments in which disclosure or non-disclosure wouldn't be impactful. A lot of these are segregated workshop environments in which the entire workforce are people with significant disabilities, and they're routed through a series of policies into those positions. So I don't think it necessarily affects disclosure, but certainly there's a great amount of stigma that goes along with living below the poverty line.
So how do we as a society get away from that model and towards something that provides equal opportunity?
Well, I think, you know, I want to take a minute just to talk a little bit about the stigma that you raised, because many people with disabilities being paid some minimum wages are themselves well below the poverty line, but a lot of times they live with family members who may or may not be below the poverty line themselves. But as far as the stigma is concerned, one of the most powerful comments our chairman at our agency ever heard as he was traveling around the country visiting work sites in which subminimum wages were paid was from a self-advocate with Down syndrome who told him that being paid subminimum wages because of his disability was like being called subhuman. And he made that connection in the words, subminimum and subhuman. And he said, since it's only for disabled people to be paid this subminimum wage, that self-advocate certainly bore a burden of stigma. And we've also heard from individuals who are now making competitive wages, but who were once employed at subminimum wages. And I remember one of them from our site visits up in Vermont told our agency during a site visit how excited she was to have had her first job. And that first job used to pay subminimum wages to her. And she was expecting a paycheck. And so when her first paycheck was to arrive, she had told her whole family that she was going to take them out for McDonald's to celebrate because she'd never made money before. And then sadly, when her paycheck did arrive, it was only for a couple of dollars for an entire work week. And she couldn't even afford to buy herself a hamburger at McDonald's. So, you know, I think those stigmas are really important to acknowledge. And your question about how do we kind of get past these with policies, you know, I think for some people with disabilities who receive subminimum wages, they've been at those jobs, some of them, sadly, for years or even decades of their lives. So they may not even know that there's an alternate model available for them. Sadly, they may have, some of them may have even adopted the low expectations that others have had for them. But one of the alternatives to subminimum wage employment that certainly the National Council on Disability has supported and advised Congress and the President to support, we've researched this alternate model at length in both our 2012 report and our recent report that just came out in October on this topic, is the model called supported employment. It's a completely different model, and the contrast is pretty stark. So in most subminimum wage work, the environment itself is segregated, and the notion is that the severity of someone's disability is so profound that the only way to facilitate their successful working would be to give them a very menial task, maybe putting bolts in a bag over and over and over, or untangling clothing hangers, or taping boxes shut, and then keep them all in one place and supervise their rote menial tasks in a segregated environment. In contrast, the model of supported employment starts with the premise that, hey, maybe people with disabilities have no interest in putting bolts in bags and untangling clothing hangers. So let's, you know, first off, ask them what their interests are and do some career exploration. And after a period of that exploration, there's usually some searching for a suitable employment opportunity that would be in an integrated competitive wage environment. And then a job coach typically is employed to help that individual learn the skills that would be required of them to successfully accomplish the expectations of the job in the environment and field of their interest. And after a relatively short period of training with that job coach, the individual typically resumes all of the tasks on their own, and they're, you know, kind of birthed into that job to do it independently. And there's a high success rate with this alternate model. And more importantly, it recognizes the individual interests and dreams of people and gives them opportunities far more in line with those goals of the ADA that we were talking about earlier, including full participation in the community, rather than a segregated environment and a competitive wage.
So, in other words, it's removing the glass ceiling.
Absolutely.
So, to look at it, if they're doing a path of their own choosing and there is room for advancement, that gives them the greater probability of economic self-sufficiency. It's not saying
right.
You can only go this far and then there's no more you can do.
Right.
So, if you could send any message about what needs to happen going forward, what would you say?
Well, I would tell your listeners that that may not know this, that people with disabilities in the U.S. live in poverty at more than twice the rate of people without disabilities. 29% versus 12% of the general population. And although people with disabilities only make up approximately 12% of the workforce, the working age population in the U.S., they account for more than half of those living in poverty. So it's they're pretty staggering statistics, and everyone always, wants to ask the question, what's the answer to the poverty-disability intersection? And there are so many spokes to the hub of poverty for people with disabilities. Everything from education, our graduation rates are far lower, and there's an obvious correlation between less education and lower wages. Housing is critical. There's growing evidence that access to decent, stable, affordable, accessible housing is the platform for better outcomes in economic mobility and educational attainment. Transportation, obviously, that's a huge barrier for a lot of people with disabilities who want to work and become economically self-sufficient, but if they can't get to their job because there's a lack of accessible transportation or a lack of an accessible environment, I know so many people who live in neighborhoods without curb cuts and sidewalks who can't even access public transportation because of the built environment. And then healthcare is a huge one. A lot of times, home and community-based services are necessary for people with disabilities to successfully attain and maintain employment. And they're generally not available from private insurance plans in the U.S., and they're too expensive to afford out of pocket. So, you know, there's so many spokes to the hub of what it will take to propel someone out of poverty that's living with disability in the U.S. And so I would caution your listeners to ever think there's a silver bullet. It really is going to take a commitment to understanding the comprehensiveness of the policy challenges that face people with disabilities, and then tackle them one by one by one. So all of those different policy areas have to be addressed, and it's really a holistic approach that's needed.
Liked, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Great, will do.
Unbelievable, my friends, to think that we can dehumanize someone to that extent. Fact is, these opportunities for betterment do exist, but if nobody's talking about them, if nobody's sitting down with a person with a disability and saying, you can have a better life, better prospects, how are they supposed to know? How are they supposed to find it? People might have this tendency to take what they're given and be grateful for it. And I do maintain there is a certain measure of gratitude between all employees and all employers on the basis that people should be grateful to have jobs. If they're meaningful, if they're contributing to the well-being of society, they provide a sense of personal fulfillment and security. But the truth of the matter is, it has to be removed. The glass ceiling has to be removed. You can't tell a person with a disability or a person of a different ethnic background or someone of a different persuasion that you can only go so far because we're the ones in charge and we're making it so. You cannot allow that to be. Equal opportunity means everyone has potential to explore their own skills, hopes, dreams, goals for the future. And none of us has the right to take that away, ever. If you're someone with a story of disability life, write HandyLink 4, HandyLink, numeral 4, gmail.com. Always love to hear from you folks at home. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.